You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Jessica Hopkins, toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rahina Monday. I'm your host, Jessica, and I'll be with you for the next hour. E whai aki nei coming up on the show. For our weekly interview, I speak to ex Karen Chua all about the Health NZ chair being sacked, the government's tourism workforce plans, and school strike for climate. I interviewed drag queens Erica and Coco Flash from Rainbow Storytime NZ about the importance of drag storytime events in Aotearoa. For Action Station this week, producer Danielle speaks to the area manager of the Citizens Advice Bureau of Auckland City, Kate Anderson, about Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown's proposal to cut funding for its service. Our Europe correspondent Cameron Adams reports on the Art is a Weapon Festival in Berlin. And Danielle interviews Paul Callister from the Institute of Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University of Wellington about why restoring long-distance passenger rail should be a part of Aotearoa's strategy for lowering its climate emissions. Hea hau whakaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of our pieces today. So get in touch, tuku pātuhi mai, text me on 5395, or why am I rane? Give us a call in the studio on 309 3879. Ka oa e wāriwāri i āhei ana koutou te whakarongo ki eni kōrero. Āno hi pakihiri roki roki maoranga i te pai tuku tuku o Ereangi Poho. Mihaere ki 95BFM i ra kati kom. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
It's time for our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chua.
For our weekly catch-up, I spoke to ACT MP Karen Chua about the Health NZ chair being sacked, the government's and workforce plans, and the school strike for climate event that took place in Tāmaki Makaurau and globally on Friday. Here is that interview. The first topic I wanted to talk to you about was the firing of Health New Zealand Chair Rob Campbell. So he was sacked as the chair of Te Whatu Ora last week over concerns he could not be politically neutral. He was also removed as chair and board member of the Environmental Protection Authority. Can you tell me about why ACT believes this was the right decision?
The minister had every right to make the decision to let him go, and we agree with their decision, and we were actually pushing for that decision before it was made, because it's important that our public services are able to continue running smoothly, no matter what government is in power, and the political neutrality is a really important part of this. The organisations need to be able to take direction from whatever government is in at the time. And Rob Campbell knew what he was doing when he made those comments in a public forum. He's been around a very long time and he knew what he'd signed up to, and he broke his contract.
Campbell has argued that he should have been allowed to express his opinion as a private citizen outside of his job, and some have cited freedom of speech being a concern. And ACT has prioritised freedom of speech in a lot of its policies. So why is this different?
Yeah, I do understand that. And if it was in a private capacity, fair enough. But when you're doing it in a LinkedIn post, which is a business forum, with everybody knowing who you are making those comments and in what capacity and what role you are making those comments, it's not a private comment. And every business has contracts and codes of conduct, and they must be followed.
In what direction would you like to see Health New Zealand go in following this recent firing?
I look forward to seeing what the new health minister is going to do. And once we see the proposals of where she wants to go with the new person, will be willing to comment then.
The government has also announced its plans to strengthen the tourism workforce, stating that the industry has been dealing with staffing issues and negative perceptions, and they've developed a better work action plan, which includes a voluntary tourism and hospitality accord to set employment standards, new tourism qualifications and training, as well as a program to build cultural competency. So your party leader, David Seymour, has called this utter crap. Can you tell me a bit about why ACT might think this is utter crap?
I think what immigration needs to do is start acting like a recruiter rather than a security guard. It needs to be simplified better, and processing times take too long right now. There's no certainty for people who are wanting to come here to fill those roles, and it takes way too long, and we've got immediate needs that are not being addressed. I mean, sure, we have to address things like training for New Zealanders here to fill those roles, but right now we have those roles open and we're desperate for these people to come, and we're talking about a six-point plan that some of these points, unless you wrote it, you wouldn't even understand what it is. I mean, embrace the flux and enable the flex. What does that actually mean? So we're getting really complicated when it should just be really easy. Bring the people in with the skills that we need to fill the immediate needs. And I think immigration is going way outside of what is actually their role. Their role is to recruit skilled immigrants to come here and fill those spaces.
Part of the government's plan is that they say they want to promote diversity and inclusion in the workforce to support the attraction and retention of Māori staff. Mm. Is this part of what ACT thinks is utter crap?
No, I think that's important, and that's an important role, but is that really a role for immigration? That could be a role under education and things like that, but is that really a role for immigration? They should be focusing on who are we bringing into this country, who are we recruiting, and what skills do we need right now to fill the gaps that we have.
And how would ACT better address tourism staffing shortages and other problems in the industry?
Look, we'd get rid of the complicated and burdensome system for temporary work visas. We'd replace it with a demand-based pricing. Let employers decide if their need is worth the price instead of all the bureaucracy and everybody telling people what they can't do instead of what they can do. We'd ensure the skilled migrant category offers an efficient and predictable pathway for migrants in all skill levels and occupations, and just remove the confusing unfairness. There's also the part where people come here and they want to start a family and they can't bring their parents along with them, and they're having to leave them behind in a different country. If they can bring their parents here and support their parents with no extra cost to the country or to the taxpayer, there should be an easier way for that to happen instead of them being separated from each other like that. So things like that that will encourage people to want to come here and put down roots and give back to our country.
And on Friday as well, thousands of school students across the country took to the streets to call for more action from the government on climate change. And the Green Party has come out in support of striking students and their demands. Does ACT support these calls for more climate action?
Oh, we always have to be sure that we are adapting to what the climate is doing, and making sure that we're keeping an eye on how climate change is affecting us. And I think it's really good that we have young people that are actually paying attention to what's going on around them and expressing their voices. It's a right in this country to protest. It's a right in this country to have a voice. And I think we're doing a lot in Parliament for young people at the moment too, to allow them to have a bigger and better voice within Parliament. I know on my select committee, we're trying the hardest to make it a lot easier for young people to submit when they've got concerns around a bill that's going through Parliament, and we are trying to make that process easier for them. So yes, I think it's great, and I'm glad they did it after 3 o'clock so it didn't interfere with their schooling, and I appreciate that they're making the effort to express themselves.
The students and School Strike for Climate have been saying that they want a greater voice. And one of the ways that they want this is by lowering the voting age to 16. So you mentioned allowing 16 and 17-year-olds to have more of a say in submissions. So what is the difference between this then and voting, having the right to vote, and why does ACT support one and not the other?
Hey, look, there are ways you can have a voice, but I think voting comes down to when you're 16, you're still a young person, you're still a child. You should be a child for as long as you can be, in my opinion. But the other aspect of this is, with voting rights comes other rights as well that we have to think about, and responsibilities. And young people need to go out in the world and experience it a bit more to understand it from the views that they are actually voting for and have experience in those places. We also have the once you're on the electoral roll, you become registered to be on a jury. At 16, are we capable of having that responsibility yet? There's more to consider than just the vote.
Yeah, and I think with the decision that it was inconsistent with the Bill of Rights, their argument would be that they are already sort of participating and sort of in that adult world, right? So is there anything that would make the ACT Party want to consider this topic more, or are you pretty hard line on no 16 and 17-year-olds, or even, you know, some 18 and 19-year-olds that aren't going to be of age by this election can vote?
Yeah, I think the ACT Party's been pretty consistent on saying no, we wouldn't support the voting age to go to 16.
Your party leader again, David Seymour's been on Twitter, and he said that, I probably should just read it out so I don't misquote. So it's, sadly, School Strike for Climate has unthinkingly adopted the hard left's hatred of capitalism and is using climate change to try to permanently shift New Zealand's politics to the left. So this was tweeted on Friday. Does ACT believe that the climate crisis is a left-wing issue?
Oh, sorry, I hadn't actually seen that tweet. I've been busy with a family event, so I mean, I can't really comment on it. It's not really my comment, but I mean, we do have to be able to have a proper debate. And unfortunately, there are a lot of situations now where unless you think a certain way, you can be shut down and not have that debate. And I do think the debate is very one-sided, and we need to have a sit-down, decent debate where both sides can have their say and find a middle ground where we can come to a compromise, where we can actually start moving forward as a country, because unless both sides can have that debate, we're never going to move forward.
So what would a compromise look like for you in terms of, I guess, the demands from the School Strike for Climate group? So they, lowering the voting age is one of them, which you've already said is a no. They're also looking for greater marine protection, fossil fuel mining or exploration, and also funding a transition to regenerative farming. So what are ACT's climate priorities, I guess, heading into the 2023 election?
Oh, look, there's a lot going on in that space. And if I'd been prepared for this question, I probably would have given you a more fulsome answer. But, I mean, we need to be making sure that when we are making climate change policies or going into that space, that the unintended consequences behind those decisions aren't going to give us a worse effect than what we've got now. We need to be forward planning, and we need to look at climate change and adapt as well as react. We can't just keep reacting to climate change. We have to adapt so that our life and the way we live doesn't decline at the same time. And so some of these policies, if we did adapt them too quickly without something to replace them, would create a worse off society. We need to be able to still have a lifestyle that we're living in, bring New Zealanders together and move forward as a country as a whole, instead of dividing us with these bills that people are feeling like they are getting run out of business and they don't know what to do.
That was our weekly catch-up with the ACT Party's Karen Chaw.
And we'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Put on an event during one of AUSA's themed weeks and they'll pay for everything. Pride Week is kicking off on April 3rd, so if you have a great idea for a gay old time, then hit them up. Just make sure it's free for all students, targeted at least 50 people, and it's queer as hell. Submissions are due on March 8th. Just fill out the proposal on the last page of the tender booklet or email engagementvp@ausa.org.nz.
The German Juggernaut. DJ, producer, and all-round dance music maestro. Michael Mayer is coming to New Zealand, and we want you to be there. Just grab your B-card and stay tuned to 95BFM Drive all this week for your cue to win tickets. Lo-Fi presents Michael Mayer with support from Drake and Olsi and Aleha. March 10th at the Mothership. Tickets from Ticket Fairy.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Welcome back. You're tuned into The Wire. Let us know your thoughts on any of our pieces today. Text in on 5395. Last week, a library in Avondale was forced to stop Drag Storytime event because of protesters. This comes as drag story times have become the target of religious groups and right-wing extremists, particularly in the US, with Republican legislators moving to ban drag in several states. I spoke to drag queens Erica and Coco Flash from Rainbow Storytime NZ about the misinformation surrounding what drag story times are and why they are important here in Aotearoa. Would you mind just telling us a little bit about Rainbow Storytime NZ and what typically happens during one of your events?
Rainbow Storytime is basically just reading really positive stories to children, usually about, you know, differences, and those differences could be all sorts of different topics, chronic illnesses, culture, religions, all sorts of things, not just about the rainbow community and LGBTQ, but yeah, just reading some really positive books to encourage people to be kind to each other, not to bully. And when you come to one of our sessions, it's an hour long, and you'll have a fun little performance, then a storybook, and another little performance in another book, and then Erica will usually come out and do a performance and then read a couple of books, and our signature is we always end with the most amazing rendition of Baby Shark.
Well, for either of you, what made you want to do this specific type of drag as a career?
Well, the funny thing was is people, you know, people seem to assume that we went out there looking for this, you know, and whether that we did or not is, you know, irrelevant. But the thing is, we actually got sought out by libraries to do it. We actually got approached by some places where we're from, Taranaki, the outskirts of Taranaki, like places like Eltham, Stratford, Inglewood, you know, they all approached us. So that's kind of what got the ball rolling. And then everyone else kind of heard about it and was like, oh my God, we need drag queens coming to our story times and our libraries too. And so that's kind of how it's evolved. It's evolved naturally, to be honest.
And there's been, I guess, a lot of focus on sort of the negative response to drag story times, but what has the response been from parents and children overall?
So the ones that actually turn up absolutely adore it. We've never had any negativity to those that actually come along to the sessions and see for themselves. They see empowerment, they see that their children gets to see someone that's like them or like their, you know, cousin Billy or whatever, and they're just like, oh, this is so cool, we love it. There's no questioning about, you know, our sexuality or our genders or anything like that. It's just people in fabulous frocks doing cool performances and reading cool books to them. So any kind of innuendo or anything that people are saying about it, they haven't turned up, they haven't seen exactly what happens, and they're kind of making it up in their own heads, really.
Just to reiterate what Coco is saying, a lot of the heat that we do get is online. A lot of it is, you know, through the comment sections on posts and things like that. And a lot of these people, you know, have, like Coco said, have never even been. That's the funny thing. It's like, how do you have an opinion on something that you have never even attended or watched or actually, you know, gone to, inspect. And that's the funny thing. I think we just live in a world where people are fearful of things they've never seen, so they try to, you know, hurl online. But really, you know, go along, watch. We even do adult story times as well, so people can come and ask questions if they have any questions that they want to ask us, you know, personal questions or why we do it, why is it that we're doing it, you know? Mm. We're open books.
Yeah, a lot of people sort of look at America, and there's a lot of propaganda that's out there in regards to the American story times, and they just trying to bring it over here. And, you know, I'm the person that kind of developed Rainbow Storytime here in New Zealand off my own format, because I had never seen it before either. So I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to develop it myself for this person that wanted it. And that's our format, and that's how we've taken it. So we're very careful about what we do and how we do things. Everyone's arguing that drag is adult entertainment, but we're professional performers. We can cater and tailor our act to an audience.
We're no different from dancers. We're no different from actors. You know, a lot of these dancers that perform at Disneyland will also go and perform for burlesque on Broadway. Do you know what I mean? There's no difference.
Yeah, so for those who may not be aware, although it does kind of seem, like you said, a bit of an obvious concept, can you kind of explain the broad spectrum of drag that kind of ranges from those more adult performances to family-friendly and how they're different?
The best way to describe drag is to compare it to, for me specifically, I always like to compare it to theatre. So we are actors, we are performers, we are entertainers. You know, if a dancer wants to, like I just said, if a dancer wants to go and perform to children at Disneyland, they can, but then they might also get hired for shows on Broadway that involve very provocative scenes, you know. That dancer is not going to bring a routine from Chicago down to Disneyland. Do you know what I mean? We do have the capability of selecting what we choose and making what we perform appropriate, you know? I think some people think drag queens lack that ability.
we can perform at Family Bar in Auckland type thing, but we're not going to do those sorts of acts, wear those same sorts of costumes at the library. We're actually very much known, Erica and Coco, as being the family-friendly drag queens, and we prefer to kind of keep it that way as much as possible. So it's kind of part of our branding that we've put together. It's hilarious how people think that drag isn't appropriate for children when you've got things like Dame Edna, you've got Mrs. Doubtfire, you've got Bugs Bunny dressing in drag, Pumbaa and Timon on The Lion King do a little drag act as well. So it's everywhere. It's, you know, it is appropriate for children in an appropriate setting with appropriate people doing it.
Has any of the sort of hatred or negative response ever made either of you consider stop doing what you're doing, or kind of deterred you from wanting to, you know, share drag and share what you're doing?
I'll be honest with you. You know, as someone who's quite strong, quite resilient, to be a drag queen, you have to be. You know, I don't ever get scared about doing it. I don't get scared of people turning up. But I do, every time I go to do a Rainbow Storytime session or we go to do one, I am always thinking, okay, what am I going to do if this happens? What am I going to have to do if that happens? You know, it's kind of all of this negative feedback has put us on edge. And I think I speak for drag queens everywhere that are doing Rainbow Storytime sessions. You know, is someone going to turn up with a weapon because, you know, they're not fans of drag? Or, you know, there are extremists out there that follow these, you know, threads online, and it can actually put us in danger, kids in danger. It can put the libraries in danger. You know, it's all of this needs to be taken seriously. And I think just by keeping doing what we're doing and being brave and being strong, definitely it will push it forward. And I think it will hopefully push it in the right direction.
Can you tell us a bit about why you believe drag queen story times or just queer visibility in general is important for young queer children in particular?
So the interesting thing is a lot of people that aren't queer will not understand this, but, you know, like we said, we do story time ambiguously, so we cater to everybody. Anyone can interpret the stories how they want, but specifically for queer awareness and stuff like that, you know, I am of the queer community, LGBT community, and when I was a kid, I always dressed up in dresses. It wasn't a matter of my sexuality. It wasn't a matter of my gender identity. It was all about just dressing up, and I wanted to put on the princess dress. You know, I also put on Batman costumes, I also put on Spider-Man costumes, but I also wanted to wear dresses. And a lot of kids are shunned, and a lot of kids are talked down to, you know, and even just by parents not knowing any better, you know. And that's kind of what we're doing. We're kind of raising awareness that dressing up is fun. It's okay. It's cool. We're not, you know, we're not turning kids into drag queens. We're just giving them a space to turn up and wear a dress if they feel like it, you know. And, you know, I think it's important, especially to queer kids, to be able to see that so they can, you know, express any possible avenues they might be thinking about and not talking about, you know. Just letting them know that there are spaces for them.
How can people support drag story times and allow them to continue to thrive in Aotearoa?
Turn up, that's the big thing. Turn up and be positive about them. If you see negativity online, question it, because usually these people haven't been or seen or know anything about what we do here in Aotearoa. And let them know that actually, no, this is a great positive thing for the queer community and for kids in general. We're not just aiming at the queer kids, we're aiming at the wider community as well. We just want kindness from everybody towards everybody, and that's what we're trying to promote. And, you know, with all these negative comments from adults coming onto social media, they're going against that grain, which just goes to prove that this kind of thing is a learned thing. And, yeah, that's why our rainbow story times and drag story times are really important. They're a positive thing. We're no different to, you know, a pirate or a fairy dressing up and coming to read stories to children at all.
Just to add to that, another thing, we understand what we're doing, you know, is, you know, still new to a lot of people. And the important thing to mention is you do not, you know, if you want to come along, but you don't have to bring your children. If you're worried or if you're concerned, you don't need to. You know, you come first and then, you know, to an adult story time and then see what it's about. You don't have to come. And a lot of these people that are, you know, spreading hate online, those are the people that, you know, aren't coming, aren't watching, aren't, you know, experiencing the story time. But, you know, we're okay with that. You don't have to come, but just don't spread the hate online. Don't tell other people how to raise their children, and don't tell parents where to take their children, if that makes sense.
Yeah, because another thing you need to look at is when this is happening online and on social media, it's the youth, the rangatahi, that are actually seeing this and realising, hell, this community isn't actually safe for me. And that's going to put them back in, and that's going to cause these issues of mental health and suicide and all these sorts of things. So we do want to make sure that anything that is online is positive, because it's actually reflecting on the wider community of what our youth are growing up to.
Even where we're from in Taranaki, we recently had, we won't say where or who or what, but we found a teacher commenting hate on one of our Rainbow Storytime sessions. And this is a teacher at a very predominant school there, a male school, in fact. And those are the kind of things that we're trying to discourage.
Yeah, exactly. We're trying to make it easier for the kids to grow up in our world rather than making it harder and keeping them self-conscious.
It's important to note to just follow, support the Auckland Art Gallery and all of the libraries, because, you know, there are other drag queens out there that are doing story times too. Just support any rainbow story time you can, you know. Follow all the libraries, and they are doing them every once in a while. But if you want to follow us, you know, follow us on Erica and Coco / on Facebook and Rainbow Story Time too. That's on Facebook and Instagram. And we will share where we're going to.
Yeah.
That was Erica and Coco Flash from Rainbow Storytime NZ discussing drag story time. And it's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future. The Auckland Citizens Advice Bureau provides free, confidential, independent information and advice to anyone who needs help with the questions about what their rights are and how to access services they need. Auckland Mayor Wayne Brown is proposing to remove their funding, which could result in the complete closure of the service in Auckland. Danielle spoke with the area manager for CAB Auckland City, Kate Anderson. They started off the interview discussing the consequences for the people of Auckland if the service closes.
Well, basically, people will have nowhere else to go to help them solve their problems. So what Citizens Advice Bureau does is that we are there to help people find the answer or navigate their way through some of life's challenges. So if you use the example of the recent floods, we had people coming to us to find somewhere else to stay temporarily, to help them find some kai, to perhaps have a bit of support with filling out their claiming on their insurance. So our volunteers are trained to help people with a whole range of, you know, help solve anything that they might turn up with, basically, and come and talk to them. And if our funding is cut, we have very little reserves, and so our service will most likely close within a really short period of time, and we really don't know where those people are going to go if that was to happen.
You have been campaigning to keep funding. Recently, you also went to the Onohunga Festival, where you collected another 755 signatures for your goal. What has been your campaign look like, and what is the progress of your campaign?
Yes, we're just trying to, again, you know, in the same way, shine the spotlight on those social issues. We're just trying to shine the spotlight on the fact that, you know, our service is, you know, we're really grateful to Auckland Council. It has funded our service for over 50 years. Citizens Advice Bureau has been around in Auckland for 52 years. We started in New Zealand 52 years ago at the Ponsonby Community Centre, and we've been funded by local government for all of that time. And, you know, if we lose that funding, it's extremely difficult to get ongoing sustainable funding. And so we're out there trying to shine spotlight on the fact that not only do we think that it would be, you know, we're hoping that people will support us and believe that Auckland Council should continue to fund us, but also highlighting, you know, how cost effective we are, because our service is provided through 900 volunteers across Tamaki Makaurau, and, you know, however you measure it, it's very effective. I think that Auckland Council cost $2 million. As I think said to you before, we saw 163,000 people. It's a very cost-effective service. And one of the ways that we can demonstrate that is that we just did a recent report was done by Impact Lab, and it looked at the social value we create, so the social good that's generated. You know, when someone comes and sees someone at COB and they have a conversation with them and they walk out knowing what their next steps are, you know, what their options are in terms of what they need to do to move forward with their problem. And if you measure that, you can measure the social good or the social value that's generated from that. We provide a $13.20 return for every $1 spent. So, you know, that's just remarkable, really, for a community organisation, and it's because we've got all of those volunteers. So coming back to your question, Daniel, sorry, I sort of went a bit off track there. You know, we were there at the festival to talk to people and say, hey, did you know this was going to happen? A lot of people were really surprised. But also to explain to them, you know, those factors about, you know, the value of our service, not only that it's there for everyone and we will help people with anything, but also that you can actually measure, you know, the social value of that and the social good.
Now, if you're taking away that funding, will maybe even cost the council more money in the long term?
Well, you know, potentially. I mean, I'm perplexed, to be honest, Daniel, because you kind of think to yourself, so there's all these people, 163,000 people, who last year thought, I know, I'm going to phone Citizens Advice Bureau, I'm going to pop in, and they're going to help me find the answer to my question. Where are they going to go? You know, libraries aren't trained to help people with this, and they don't have time. In fact, they're cutting the hours and the staff of libraries. So, you know, potentially their call centres will be overloaded. You know, I just don't know. And then you look at that's just in terms of the front end of all those inquiries. When you look at the cost of things, of people not being able to solve their problems, you know, like when someone comes in with a tenancy issue, for example, and we help them either stay in their current property or find a new one, you know, if they can't get that kind of help, people become homeless. Well, how do you value that? So, yes, it may cost Auckland Council more, but it will certainly cost our communities more in terms of the impact it will have on them.
What can people do to help? There is a petition, I signed it. You're almost at 10,000 signatures. People can sign that, I guess, but what can people do more? And also, when we arrive at the 10,000, what will happen then?
we're going to fix, you know, hopefully a lot more than 10,000. With the 755 we got on Saturday, I think we're going to be well over that 10,000 quite quickly, I think. And that was a target we set initially for ourselves. So yes, please go to cab.org.nz/petition, and that will take you through to Action Station so that you can sign a petition. We encourage you to go to Auckland Council's website. There's the opportunity to have your say. If you find navigating the digital world difficult, go into a Citizens Advice Bureau and they can help you have your say. So that's an online petition. There's also paper-based petition, or not petitions, paper-based consultation documents that you can pick up in any library. And that's the way to have your say.
Yeah, this budget cut is part of the whole annual budget plan of the Auckland Council.
Yes,
and,
yes.
And there's now a moment to give feedback on that, right? This whole month, yes. You can give feedback on this plan.
Yes, you can give feedback before the 28th of March, I think. And, you know, there's no doubt that our seniors are in a difficult situation and they need to find a significant amount of money to... you know, to provide a resolution to the budget, you know, to fill that gap. That is a challenge, but in my view, I don't think that, you know, cutting at this point in time where, you know, life's getting more difficult for people, there's a lot more challenges, things are getting more complex. You know, we've just come out of 3 years of COVID and people are highly stressed. Cost of living is going up. I just don't think it's the time to cut in that community sector, and we should consider other ways to fill that funding gap. But yes, go online, have your say, Auckland Council, and you'll find or go on, you know, the consultation documents where you can give feedback.
That was the area manager for CAB Auckland City, Kate Anderson. We'll be right back after a short break.
Put on an event during one of AUSA's themed weeks and they'll pay for everything. International Week kicks off May 8th, so this is your cue to get cultural. Just make sure that your event is free for all students, targeted at least 50 people, and deep into the heritage, customs and food of Auckland Uni's diverse campus. Submissions are due March 8th. Just fill out the proposal on the last page of the tender booklet or email engagementvp@ausa.org.nz.
Music's everywhere. Everywhere. It's like a cloud of art. Here at 95 BFM, we've sucked up some of the best contemporary bangers, bottled them and chucked them into a special Spotify playlist just for you. Just for you.
The March playlist is up and features tracks from Crystal Chen, Mr. Ho, Greco Romanc, Office Dog, Tanuki-chan and Unknown Mortal Orchestra.
Follow 95BFM on Spotify for our monthly Spotify playlist and stay au fait.
Unexpectedly heartfelt ukulele performance there from Iceland.
It's Eurovision on 95BFM with our European correspondent Cameron Adams.
Over the anniversary of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, which began 1 year ago, the Ukrainian Art as a Weapon Festival was held in Berlin. The festival was an all-day and night arts and music festival which saw many Ukrainian male artists getting special permission to leave Ukraine to attend. European correspondent Cameron Adams reports from the festival, and this includes an interview with Kiev-based DJ Badworth.
All right, it's Cameron Adams for BFM here. I'm at the Art as Weapon Festival here in Berlin on a snowy Saturday night. It's been a whole day exhibition of Ukrainian arts with band and theatre performances, panel discussions, artist exhibitions, and even a pop-up tattoo studio. Right now, it's the techno part of the evening inside the Old Mint Building of Berlin with Ukrainian DJs performing a very lively and well-received set. Thousands of people have turned up throughout the day today to show their solidarity, check out the exhibitions and provide their support, with the money raised going to support the group Musicians Defend Ukraine, who are currently fundraising for more night vision devices to help with civilian evacuations and military exercises. I spoke with Valeria, one of the Ukrainian volunteers at the festival, and asked her how the festival has been.
It was really great to see so many Ukrainian people united in this place and to hear Ukrainian music and Ukrainian bands. And also, for me, it was nice experience of volunteering and helping other people to organize this event and to see everything from inside position.
Yeah, and how does it kind of feel being here as this big kind of Ukraine arts festival?
It feels like home, and it's very strange because we are right now in Berlin, and I'm a foreigner here, but right now it feels so different because of people around, and everybody's so open, and I hear my own language, and because of course so many Ukrainians here, and just good vibes to see people hanging out and just being in the city together, united. Yeah.
The next day I spoke with Badworth, a Kiev-based DJ who got special permission by the Ministry of Culture to leave Ukraine to perform at the festival.
How was last night in Berlin?
It was pretty nice. It was exhausting, but I really liked the vibe, and all the people that came were really happy to see each other, to see me, and I was happy to see them. So yeah, it went pretty well.
Did it remind you at all of Kiev's kind of nightlife?
It did, in fact, remind me of Kiev nightlife, the one that was there before the full-scale war, because there were so many people that I saw the last time, like 2.5 years ago. And so that brought me a lot of memories, and I was feeling like it was kind of surreal to see all of those people in one place.
How has it been kind of over the past year in Kiev, especially with like the nightlife and stuff like that?
So for the first 4 months, it was absolutely quiet. It was inappropriate in people's minds to even think about partying, which was absolutely morally right. And I felt like that as well. But it was back in May 2022 when Harry Pletov from Polygon decided to make a festival. That was exactly what happened last night in Berlin. He made the first Art Weapon Festival in Kiev. It was not like a festival, it was an event, an art event. And it was one of the first, if not the very first events since the beginning of war. Around that time, like the end of May, I've noticed that people are really missing the times that they could commune and see each other and exchange their experiences, to not feel that lonely and isolation, trying to hide from the shellings. And so summer was the period of time when a lot of new parties appeared in Kyiv. I cannot really tell you more about other cities because I didn't really do my research, but in Kyiv there were a lot of them, and it was really fresh for people because it was a new experience, at least because we have that what's it called in English? It's when we can't really go out after
curfew.
Yeah, curfew. Right. And so all the night parties and all the brands of night parties that people knew had to adapt themselves to be held during daytime. I would say that people accepted that pretty good because that's better than nothing. And also most of them, I cannot like promise that everyone does that, but like in my circles, it's like every single party that gathers money to donate to something, either humanitarian help or buy some drones for the army and stuff like that.
And then how was it over winter with the power cuts?
Yeah, so that started around October, and that was not so long after my own paradigm shift, because before the middle of October, I felt relatively safe. Like I've accepted the concept of relative safety, and that was because I'm living in the centrum of Kyiv. That area was never shelled before that time. But one morning I woke up and saw that in 20 meters away from the entrance to the university building I attended for 4 years, the rocket fell, and like 50 or 100 meters from that, it fell in a park that I am going through every single day that I'm attending something in in the Centrum. And so it was a moment that I realized that I'm not that safe as I would like to think in my head. And then the electricity cuts kicked in. To be fair, I was lucky enough to spend an extra month after that point in time to not have them. I don't really know the reasons, but then they've kicked in, and it was really cold, and it was really tied to the water supply and to the heating, because if electricity cuts off, then the rest stops as well. And it took some time before that stopped being a problem, because then we started having those scheduled electricity cuts and no water cuts. During wartime, actually, I coped with what was happening through music, because I took my laptop with me to the village house where I was trying to hide. Yeah, I was just trying things, and around March was when I came up with that remix called Glory to Ukraine. So there's that meme song that samples a really shady guy, to be honest, that had a really funny quote about Russian Federation being screwed. And so there was another viral track with that quote that sounded really pop-ish. And I realized that I could benefit from the power of the quote, but make it more stylish and harder, and so it fitted my own sets. So I did that, and somehow that went viral, and it was the first track of mine that went viral that was not a collab and was in a genre that is one of my main ones right now, because previously I had a part of my music career that focused on other genres of music that I no longer make. And so it was an inspiring shift for me. Then I was working with Chocolab on our EP that we started before the war. And we spent a month translating a part of a number of songs from the EP, because they had Russian lyrics in them, and that was inappropriate for us to keep them like that. Yeah, we were trying to brainstorm and work on new demos. Yeah, it was till the end of May, as I said before, and then we came back to Kyiv, and a lot of parties appeared in Kyiv, and we have realized that people are really hungry for electronic music meetings in general, and B, harder styles of music, because I see the connection between the fact that they respond so well to that and their necessity to express their own anger and reflection of what's happening.
What are your hopes for after the war?
Oh, I wouldn't say I am thinking much about that, because I don't want to set my expectations really high. And when I say that, I mean that expecting the war to end really soon is a high expectation that seems unreal to me. So my take is it may take several years. So I'm prepared for the worst. I think from what I see subjectively, people in Ukraine are kind of adapted to living during war. But when it ends and when we win, I think it will be the exact moment when our trauma rises and goes above the It goes out, and we realize the scale of the bad things that happen to each of us and to our relatives and to our nation, and that will take time to it will take time for us to recover emotionally from that.
Macedonia with a reggae twist.
That was Eurovision on 95 BFM.
The New Zealand government has decarbonisation targets that require significant cuts to transport-related emissions, but decarbonising long-distance travel is not a part of the plan. Paul Callister from the Institute of Governance and Policy Studies at Victoria University of Wellington argues that restoring long-distance passenger rail needs to be part of Aotearoa's strategy to bring emissions down. Callister is also part of the Save Our Trains group that campaigns for a national strategy for inter-regional passenger rail services. Producer Danielle started off by asking Callister about the historical context of the current imbalance between rails and roads in Aotearoa.
It's really a long story. I mean, rail was very much the centre of transport in early New Zealand. It opened up lots of areas and really was the only practical way of getting around, apart from, you know, dangerous coastal shipping. So at one stage in New Zealand, everybody travelled by rail. But the changes started to occur mainly when the airlines came into New Zealand and they started offering cheaper fares. But the really big hit was from when cheap cars were started to import it into New Zealand. So there were two factors that were making it really difficult for rail. But they were also factors that we saw in other countries like Switzerland, Norway, Britain. So it wasn't unique to New Zealand. The big difference in New Zealand is that there was a real push against railways for a while. And that included the privatisation of the railways in the 1990s. And so there was a big lack of investment. And really, just one by one, the passenger rail services got scrapped. So we're now in a situation where we still have a great rail network throughout New Zealand. You know, rail goes through just about every small town and big city in New Zealand. There's only a couple of places really that are off the rail network, Queenstown and the Nelson area. So we do have the railway lines there. We just don't have the passenger trains running on them.
Why was this push against rail happening?
It was part of the whole sort of neoliberal agenda. It was very much the idea that the state was pulling back from being heavily involved in the transport sector. At that stage, it also sold off the bus company, Intercity Bus. And there was a real enthusiasm for building roads as well. It was when the motorways went into places like Auckland and Wellington, probably a little bit before that. The Auckland urban rail system was pretty run down as well. And the Wellington urban rail system was collapsing to a certain degree. I mean, trains were just breaking down and such like. So there just wasn't the enthusiasm from the government sector. And really, things like climate change were not really thought about in those days. So it was the idea that we could more efficiently move people around by cars and planes. And, you know, rail had seen was a thing of the past. Now, of course, we've got to look at it completely differently. And there's a number of factors that have changed. I mean, climate change is a really big issue. So we know rail's fantastic in terms of emissions and very energy efficient. But the population's changing as well. I mean, a lot of young people are now not getting driver's licenses. And we've got an aging population as well. And so as people age, sometimes they have to give up driving. So there's a number of factors that have changed that really do support rail again.
New Zealand has the emissions reduction plan, and that aims to for a reduction of 20% in driving per capita by 2035. How important is the role of a big network intercity rail in New Zealand to get that goal?
Well, we were very disappointed that the emission reduction plan virtually didn't talk about passenger rail. It's missing out of that. And the Climate Commission doesn't really talk about it. The rail plan, which was produced by the Ministry of Transport, doesn't particularly talk about rail. So there's been big missed opportunities. And what we think is that if you're going to reduce driving in the big cities and people do shift to buses and walking and cycling, then people are going to get rid of their cars. They might get rid of their second car. And so intercity travel, efficient intercity travel, will become even more important. And, you know, we're pretty realistic in what we're asking for. We see some very low-hanging fruit in terms of the so-called Golden Triangle. That's Auckland, Hamilton, Tauranga, where, you know, they're big population centres. And there's existing railway lines between them. And Te Huia was started, but it started off in a difficult way. It started off during the pandemic. Initially, the train didn't go right into central Auckland. It wasn't running in weekends, and that's starting to be a bit better now. So, yeah, we see real opportunities for trains, but it's going to be a slow process, and we need government backing, and that's why we're holding a conference in the end of June called The Future is Rail. And we've got the Minister of Transport talking at that conference. We have a number of government officials. So we really want a good discussion at that conference about how rail can be part of our emissions reduction.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.